which is again is why this generational ban is such an so ludicrous, because it's just treating young adults like kids. I was put off politics when I was at university because student politics was just a bear pit. And what I saw very early on is that in politics, you spend most of your time fighting people on your own side. Hello, hello, wherever you are. This is Christopher Snowden. You're watching another episode of The Swift Half with Snowden. And if you've seen the show before, you probably know what you're in for. It's very, very straightforward. It's just 30 minutes of chat between me and somebody I like and am interested in. And this week it is my old friend Simon Clark, who is the boss at the Freedom Organisation for the Right to Enjoy Smoking Tobacco or Forest for Much Shorter. Simon, how are you doing? Thank you very much for joining me.
Hello, Christopher. Very happy to be here.
Good. Now, I want to talk to you about smoking later on, but I also want to talk to you about all the other things you've done in your life. Now, people watching this, you may not even know it, viewers, but you almost certainly would have seen or heard Simon at some point in your lives on the radio, defending the rights of smokers. I don't know how many interviews you've done. How many do you think you do a year? Do you work it out?
Well, fewer in recent years, but overall, we're talking about several thousand easily. I mean, a lot on local radio, so obviously, you know, and it's not always national, but a lot of local radio stations. And I've done a lot of student radio programs over the years. I've always felt they're just as important, because it's amazing how often you can do a student program, and several years later, the person who was interviewing you pops up working for the BBC, and it's actually, you know, worked out very well.
That's a good point. And how long, when did you start, Forrest? Remind me.
1999. Before that, I'd been a freelance journalist for 15 years.
Yeah.
And that's what I wanted to do from a very, very young age. But I was enticed into PR when I left university, because I joined a PR company whose office was at the bottom of Fleet Street. So at that stage, I never believed that I'd be so close to Fleet Street.
Right.
When, of course, I should have gone off and ended up working for the Barrow Evening Times or something like that, which I'd have been happy to do. But I went into PR, and that was a bad thing to do in those days, because in those days there was a big line between public relations and journalism. Journalists hated anybody in PR. But of course now you can barely, you know, there's no different
revolving doors.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, so when was this?
Well, it's 1980 when I left university.
Right.
So I did PR for a few years and didn't really enjoy it, which, of course, is ironic, because in a way what I do now is a form of PR. But at the time, we were working for clients, and I just felt some of the things that we were doing, it was all so trivial. So anyway, I got out of that. I relaunched a student magazine that I had launched in Aberdeen. We launched it as a national student magazine. It was anti-NUS, anti the National Union of Students. Basically, it was a student version of Private Eye. And we tried to make that work as a commercial concern, but we got ourselves banned by 40 different student unions around the country.
It got cancelled.
Well, it got cancelled. One of the really early people to get cancelled. But we got round it by basically going on to campuses, going on to into halls of residences, and went around knocking on doors, selling this magazine door to door. So essentially, I became a door-to-door salesman for a while. But eventually, you know, that led to other things. And for 15 years, I edited lots of other magazines. And yes, I enjoyed that.
Tell us about that. Because you've been in the vanguard of sort of libertarianism, in a way. Slightly, maybe conservative libertarianism for quite a long time in various different guises.
I've been on the edges of politics. I mean, actually, I was put off politics when I was at university because student politics was just a bear pit. And what I saw very early on is that in politics, you spend most of your time fighting people on your own side. Mm. Because obviously, everybody wants to get to the top, whether it's in their local student group or once they get into local or national politics. And there's people who basically you couldn't put a cigarette paper between their policies, they actually end up becoming mortal enemies simply because they both can't end up getting to the top. And I've seen some very good people over the years, their careers have been ended purely because they've been sort of defeated by people who, quite frankly, aren't fit to clean their shoes. But it's all become about that. And that's why I've always hated that about politics. And one of the reasons that Forest, for example, has never become a full-blown membership organization is because I've worked for membership organizations. And again, politics takes over. A lot of personalities get involved and personalities fall out. And as soon as you start having an organization that has committees and has elected positions, you're always fighting with one another and you get very little done. So actually, Forest has always been what I would describe as a benign dictatorship. And actually, I was...
Even before your day?
Oh, well, long before my day. I mean, actually, Forest has been going now for 45 years, 45th year.
79, yes.
Yep. And it was set up originally by a pipe smoker, a Battle of Britain fighter pilot, Sir Christopher Foxley Norris. And the legend is that he was standing on the platform at Reading Railway Station one day, an old biddy marched up to him and told him to put his pipe out. He's thinking to himself, hang on a sec, you know, I fought the Battle of Britain for you. I helped save this country. You're now telling me I can't smoke outdoors on a railway station?
You can smoke in the train in those days.
Oh,
right?
Yes, absolutely, yes. but anyway, so he set up Forest, and within 2-3 years, they appointed a full-time paid director. And actually, I interviewed him for our student magazine back in 1984. It was a chap called Stephen Ayres, who sadly died in 1990, not of a smoking-related illness. He was then superseded by a guy called Chris Tame, who used to work, well, his big interest, the Libertarian Alliance, which he'd founded in the mid-80s. And Chris took Forrest perhaps in a more ideological direction, certainly a libertarian direction. And then he was replaced mid-90s by Marjorie Nicholson, who became quite an expert in air filtration systems. Because at that time, there was talk about passive smoking. Mm-hmm. Passive smoking was just becoming an issue. And Marjorie became, well, in fact, she became a consultant to Gatwick and Heathrow airports, you know, unpaid because she was still working for Forest. And she would advise them on how to put in smoking zones at Heathrow and Gatwick, which had these incredible, what they call air walls. Mm. So you'd have all air curtains. And people could smoke in these designated areas very comfortably. They'd be sitting on sofas and so on, and there'd be no smoke drift at all. And I saw then that actually technology can solve any issues.
What was an air? Is that just air being shot down?
Yes, essentially. I mean, it was a Japanese company. There was one Japanese company called Tornex, I think they were called. And they came up with these air curtains that would prevent any smoke drift at all. I think other companies were producing similar things. And actually, when I was interviewed for the job at Forest in 1999 by Lord Harris of High Cross, I sat there with him and Marjorie, and we sat round this large table, which was in the old Forest office. And in the middle of this large table was a huge, ginormous ashtray. And they put all these sandwiches out around this ashtray. And every time, Marjorie was a heavy smoker, and every time Marjorie leant across with her cigarette, or Lord Harris with his pipe, ash would fall onto the sandwiches. And I remember thinking, this is interesting. But above us was this air filtration unit, which sucked all the particles from the tobacco smoke, sucked them immediately. And I was amazed by how well this worked. Because in our old office, you know, we had 4 full-time staff, 2 were regular smokers, and there was never an issue. So I've never been a smoker myself, but I've seen how the technology works, and having people smoking around me has just never bothered me at all. But originally, when I started at Forest, I planned to do it for 2-3 years, and then I planned to move on. But actually, I sort of started at Forest at the time that the whole issue around the smoking ban was beginning to gear up. I mean, it started many years before the ban actually came in.
Yeah.
And once I got involved in that fight, I loved it, actually, because it was a challenge. And I met some fantastic people who wanted to sort of fight the same fight. I've told you this story before, Chris, but one of the things that really got me invested in the whole smoking issue was very early on when I worked for Forest, I was sent to Seville to attend a conference. and it was described as a conference of smokers' rights activists. And I have to say, my heart sank a bit because I thought, I'm going to be going out there. I'm going to be surrounded by all these
nutters,
yes, and these, you know, hard case libertarians. I mean, I'm not a hard case libertarian, and I realised that one year when I went to Oxford to address the Hayek Society at Oxford. And these guys, they all wanted to legalize heroin. I mean, any drug, they basically wanted to legalize. And I don't go as far as that. So I realize I'm not actually a true libertarian. And there's plenty of things I would ban if I had a chance. You know, noisy neighbors, I mean, I would ban them. And there's lots of things. Cyclists, I wouldn't necessarily ban them, but I'd certainly introduce a lot of restrictions. So, no, I'm not a libertarian. Smokies are a different thing because... I generally believe, particularly now we've got the smoking ban in place, which is a bad thing. And, of course, in a perfect world, it would be amended. It's not going to happen. So we've got to fight what's happening now rather than what was happening 20 years ago. But, you know, the idea that the smoking ban might be extended to outdoor public places, or there might be a generational ban on the sale of tobacco introduced, I mean, I just find it absolutely extraordinary. And it's amazing how we've come so far in just 20 years with the amount of legislation and regulations and restrictions on people's habits. It's unbelievable.
It really is. Mostly under a Conservative government as well.
Yeah, which is shocking, isn't it, really? I mean, who would have thought this 20 years ago when it was a Labour government that introduced the ban on tobacco advertising and sponsorship? Mm-hmm. Then it was a Labour government that introduced the smoking ban, and it was a Labour government that introduced the legislation on to ban the display of tobacco in shops. Yeah. But of course, it was Cameron's government, the coalition government, that actually enforced that legislation. So it was pretty clear early on that there was going to be very little difference between the Blair-Brown government that was in power and then the coalition government that we had under David Cameron, because of course they introduced plain packaging as well.
So just going back a little bit, so go back to the mid-80s. So you've got Chris Tame in charge at Forest. What are you doing at that time?
Well, back in the 80s, for a while, I actually ran something called the Media Monitoring Unit. I was recruited by... Well, it came about because of the student magazine that I had launched. And somebody who helped me with that was Julian Lewis, who at the time was running an organization called... CPS, Campaign for Peace Through Security. It was an anti-C&D campaign, and it was successful in arguing the case for Britain having a nuclear deterrent. And so I got to know Julian, and this was before he became an MP, became a Conservative MP in 1997. But at the time, he was also running a small sort of political consultancy. So he recruited me to run this thing called the Media Monitoring Unit. Because back in the 80s, because you know, the Conservatives had such a big majority under Margaret Thatcher, there was definitely a sense that there was a lot of bias in the media against the Thatcher government, particularly from the BBC. So, of course, we had to, there's no good saying, oh, you know, there's bias in the media. You've got to go out and actually prove it. So my job for 5 years, I basically, it was a very small operation. I worked from home in a dark basement room, watching hour upon hour of programs like Panorama, World in Action, Doctor TV.
That's one of the worst ones.
More recently, yeah. Well, people have said that, actually. We were focusing on current affairs programs, and we produced our first report, which was a sort of as thick as a telephone directory in those days. And it got a huge amount of coverage. The Evening Standard actually broke our embargo. And all over London, there were these posters everywhere saying, yes, the BBC is biased. And that was probably a high point of my career.
So what was the sort of headline? What was the main facts?
Well, what I had to do, and of course in hindsight, maybe it was just a little bit subjective, but obviously my job was to watch all these programs and then rate them for bias. Now, people might mock it these days, but I mean, what we were looking at was whether or not interviews were balanced. We didn't expect every single program. I mean, let's say there might be a dozen programs in the series of Panorama. We didn't expect every single program to be balanced. That would be ludicrous. But over a series, you'd expect there to be as many left-wing targets as right-wing targets. But what you'd actually find is that perhaps 10 of those 12 programs were targeting the government, the Thatcher government, or targeting groups on the right, only two would be doing it against left-wing targets. And, I mean, bias was actually complete. It was utterly rife. And, of course, it hasn't really changed in the last 30 years. I think it's still just as bad as it was. At the time, I think we did make the, you know, we did give the BBC in particular pause for thought, I think, because when we had our first launch of our first report, BBC and ITV sent executives to the launch. So they took on board what we were saying. Mm-hmm. And every year we used to publish our reports between Christmas and New Year, which is obviously quite a slow news time. So we'd always get banner headlines. Mm-hmm. And of course, the media, particularly the right-wing media, loved what we were saying about the BBC. So we'd get a lot of coverage. And that went on for about 5 years. And it was specifically that 5 years because it was leading up to I think there was something to do with the Broadcasting Act being revised, or the charter was being revised, something like that. So we like to think that we did have a little bit of an impact. But the Media Monitor closed down, ostensibly, because it was perceived to have done its job.
That's good.
And then we moved on to start doing to do more magazines.
Yeah. The BBC, going back to the BBC, I mean, it's the worst thing about it is I genuinely don't think that they think they're biased. I don't think it's a deliberate thing. It's not sort of like pro-Labour, anti-Tories per se. It's not even party political. It's just this culture in which it is assumed that the government must be doing more all the time. And I mean, there was one, I don't listen to the Today programme, but occasionally I feel I must listen to a particular segment because people are talking about it and it's about something I write about. And they had ultra-processed food, some story about ultra-processed food. It was from Jamie Oliver's group, Bite Back 2030. And I can't actually remember what the content of the report was, but it was about, he was saying that 70% of the food produced by the biggest food manufacturers is high in fat, sugar, and salt, which is not particularly surprising, and there's not a lot they can do about it, right? That's what people want to buy. Anyway, they came up with this. It was a big story, apparently, on the Today programme. And to respond to this story, they got somebody, a kid, an 18-year-old lad, who works for or is a youth activist at Bite Back 2030. And obviously he thought it was an excellent report and the government should act on that. Going, well, that's a bit weird. And then as the sort of second opinion, they get Chris Van Tulleken on, who'd written this book about ultra-processed food. And he thought it was a fantastic report as well. And that was it. There was two guests, one from the organisation that says, publish this thing, and then from a guy who's very clearly going to say, yeah, it's not just food, it's high fat and salt, it's all ultra processed food. And this, every time occasionally I get in the car and Radio 4 comes on, it's just amazing how bad it is. And even the sort of 6 o'clock news, on the rare occasions I turn it on, I'm always appalled at how dumbed down it is. I mean, having, for example, to explain what inflation is every time you mention inflation is kind of treating the audience like idiots, I think. But also, again, just this constant, you know, the government must be doing more, must be spending more, and therefore must be taxing more. I find quite wearisome. How do you feel the BBC is on issues of smoking?
Well, I suppose it's not just the BBC, it's the establishment generally, isn't it? I mean, the reality is we are in a minority with our views. The establishment has decided that smoking is a bad thing, and by hook or by crook, they want to make it obsolete. I mean, where do we start? I mean, I can't complain to some extent because over the years, we've done many, many interviews with the BBC. I mean, even this week, I've given quotes to BBC News. Yeah.
You are the go-to person for any comment. If they feel they must have an opposing view, which I guess the charter says they kind of have to.
Yes. I mean, I think this week was interesting because on one occasion they contacted me and asked for a quote, and then the quote didn't appear in the report. So I had to chase them up and say, why has my quote not appeared? You've quoted Deborah Arnott from ASH, but you've left out the quote that you asked for. So they didn't then added it. They updated their report to add it. I do spend a ludicrous amount of my time chasing journalists. I mean, sometimes, you know, a story might appear on the BBC News website 11 o'clock at night, and it's very one-sided, and I'll be ringing the night desk editor and saying, you know, we put out our response, you haven't included it. And almost always they'll actually agree with me. They'll say, yes, you know, we will put something in. So I don't know why it is. I mean, obviously, journalism has changed enormously over the last 20 years. I mean, I accept that newspapers, for example, are poorly staffed. And because so many stories are now published online, journalists in the old days were perhaps writing one story a day, maybe not even every day. They might have 2 or 3 days to write a story. But of course, these days, they're under enormous pressure to just churn stuff around. And that's why we see so much cut and paste journalism. And they will literally take a press release from a group like Ash, and they'll basically put it out. They might tweak it a little bit, but essentially it's the press release. Yeah. And I won't say the person's name or even the organization, but I had this bizarre correspondence or conversation with one journalist for a leading news agency, shall we say. And I was complaining that they'd put out a very one-sided story, which had no comment from an opposing view. And they said to me, well, you could have sent me a response. And I said, well, I haven't actually received, Ash do not send me their press releases in advance so I can comment on them. Mm. Unless you contact me for a response, I don't even know the story is out there. And to me, I mean, because I say, I started off not in newspaper journalism, but I worked in journalism. And one thing I was always led to believe is that you pick up the phone and you ring round and you get a variety of voices, basic opinions. Yeah. That is basic stuff. But these days, they basically say, well, I haven't got time. Well, I'm sorry, make time, for heaven's sake. That's your job.
You think that's what it is? You don't think it's necessarily just bias and that they can't even see? Because I would think with smoking a lot and can't even imagine there's another side to the argument.
Right.
It's so self-evident that smoking is terrible and must be suppressed by the state.
Yeah, I think we're moving in that direction. I think there's still a reasonable number of journalists who do understand that there's another side to the story. And that's why we still get quite a lot of interviews, particularly on local radio, where they will contact us because they do want a proper debate. But no, we're certainly edging in the direction where, as you say, they seem to have convinced themselves that smoking is such a bad thing. I mean, it makes me laugh the number of times I will go on do interviews about smoking. And I'll say, you do realize that a lot of smokers do enjoy smoking and they get pleasure from smoking. We have the research to prove it. This is not to say that, you know, smokers are not well aware of the health risks of smoking. Of course they are. It's been rammed down their throats for 50 years. I mean, there cannot be a sane adult or even teenager in the UK who isn't well aware of the health risks of smoking, which is, again, is why this generational ban is such so ludicrous, because it's just treating young adults like kids. And we're going to, you know, bring up a generation or future generations of adults who are not being, rather being encouraged to make their own decisions about their own lifestyle, will be literally waiting for government to make that decision for them. And as you know, it will not stop with smoking. I mean, it'll move on to vaping very quickly. I mean, we're always seeing that, of course, with the ban on disposable vapes. Yeah, I mean, they're going to be restricting the packaging. They're going to, there's talk about display bans. I mean, all these things. It's going to happen with vaping. And of course, again, it's already happening on alcohol as well.
Mm. Oh, the alcohol groups are cock-a-hoop about this. They're going like, oh, don't forget about us.
I know.
Now, if that's the path we're going down now, if it's pure paternalism and you're going to ban people from doing something completely, you're not going to come up with any excuses about the children or the advertising or any of this kind of stuff. It's just, we don't like it, we're going to ban it. I mean, it really does cross the Rubicon, doesn't it? I think the most terrifying thing about it, that really everybody, including people like me who don't smoke, and yourself, you know, it's easy to overdo the slippery slope kind of argument. But let's face it, the slippery slope's been right so far, hasn't it? Every step of the way, people like me and you have warned about the slippery slope. And if you carry on like this, we're going to end up banning cigarettes. And what did they say to us? Don't be ridiculous. It never happened. It's a slippery slope argument.
Yeah, and I mean, you've used that argument as well, where back in 1998, Ash were merely calling for more smoke-free areas and restaurants. Yeah. And yet, 6-7 years later, we had a complete ban on smoking in every single pub and private members club in the country. So these things can happen incredibly quickly. And I suppose, from my point of view, the frustration has been that it's been very difficult to get the general public to really engage in this. Now, you can understand it up to a point, because If you don't smoke, you're thinking, well, it doesn't really bother me, doesn't affect me directly. But we've kept saying to people, you must take an interest in this. Because, okay, today, I mean, I've always regarded smoking as a bellwether of liberty, if you like. It's the canary, isn't it? Because what will happen? What happens?
It's a buffer as well for people. I've always said, you know, smoking is obviously so much more harmful than these other things. That so long as they're leaving smokers more or less alone, everybody else is safe. Because they can't go after something like alcohol if they're still allowing people to smoke. Of course, if they're not allowing smoking, then it's open season.
Well, exactly. And this is why I found the response of a lot of vapers and vaping advocates quite disappointing, because they're happy to throw smokers under the bus. And we've set...
I don't think that's fair of most of the actual sort of advocate, kind of vaping activists, as it were. I think most of them get it. It may well be true of rank and file vapers, but that's true. It's true with everybody, like you say. Maybe it's very hard to mobilize people. But don't forget, you know, it's easy to say, you know, there's not much in the way of grassroots activism against all this stuff. And politicians might recognize that and go, in that case, we might as well do more of it. But there's no grassroots activism against it.
No, exactly.
There's no grassroots anti-drinking, anti-sugar, anti-smoking. Never has been, which is why you end up with state-funded groups doing it, because nobody else is going to do it. So the state creates and funds their own front groups, essentially, these sock puppets I've written about, which is a scandal, in my view.
Yeah, absolutely. And when we have these public consultations, of course, it's never really revealed who is contributing to these consultations. But we know that the public health industry are mobilizing.
Well, it used to always be revealed. It's only this recent one they're not giving the names.
Yeah, what they used to do. Yeah, they wouldn't reveal the name of individuals. I'm not suggesting they perhaps should reveal individuals. But, for example, I remember there was a consultation back in about 2008, probably before the display ban, I think. And there was a response of something like 96,000, and the overwhelming majority were basically mobilized from the public health industry because, you know, if you work for the NHS, you were encouraged to...
Every NHS trust responds.
Yeah.
Identikit responds.
So what we vowed when it came around to plain packaging that we were not going to get beaten on numbers again. So we organized a street petition over the period of the consultation, and over the 3 months, it was eventually 4 months, actually, the period the consultation was going on for, we eventually raised over 260,000 signatures. And there were other petitions taking place at the same time. So eventually, when they were all submitted as part of the consultation response, I think the figure was something like 460,000 people opposed to plain packaging. Yeah. On the other side, in favour of plain packaging was about 230,000. So we completely wiped the floor with them. And what did the government do?
They said it's not a numbers game.
Yes,
it's about quality responses. Not quality.
Totally ignored it. It was just absolutely pathetic. And then this most recent consultation, which was suddenly most consultations are 3 months. This consultation was 8 weeks. And the government had already announced it was wanted to introduce the generational display ban and the ban on disposable vapes. So why are we having a consultation if you've already made up your mind?
Because it's a legal requirement.
Yeah.
That's all it is to it.
So, yeah, it's box ticking. And, of course, now they won't even publish the names of the people who have contributed. And even more bizarrely, I mean, it's completely unprecedented in as far as I'm aware, they won't actually reveal not just the names of the organisations, but they're actually saying they will not consider the views of anybody who has some link with the tobacco industry. Now, that could include independent retailers.
It will do, yeah.
So independent retailers are being ignored, and it's their businesses that could be at risk if they lose even more customers because of all the other regulations that we've had in the past. And we know the impact the smoking ban had on pubs. I mean, to this day, the anti-smoking lobby ignore that. And they say, oh, no, it had no effect whatsoever. Well, of course, it wasn't the only factor in the demise of the pub over the last 15 years, but it was a significant factor.
You only had to be going to pubs at the time to see before and after.
Absolutely.
And so we're nearly up to half an hour. Oh, we can talk for hours, I know. But let me finish with one last question. 25 years in the saddle now. Pretty much. When he started, you could smoke pretty much anywhere. A pack of cigarettes was £2.
I know where this is going.
I'm not going to say your career has been a failure. So I'm going to ask you, if you don't you find it incredibly depressing? I don't know how you keep doing. I mean, I write about the same kind of things. I find it very depressing, but at least I can switch between different subjects when it gets a bit a bit too much, where you're just constantly at it. I mean, it's grim, isn't it?
Well, I've enjoyed the job because it's always been a challenge. I mean, I can't imagine anything more boring than doing a job where you're pushing on an open door all the time. And if you're in the anti-smoking lobby, you basically are pushing on an open door. Mm. So I've loved it. I've met some fantastic people over the years. And the thing that keeps me going is the fact that many of the people that I've grown up with over the years have been smokers. And I know that there are some people who wish they'd never started smoking and wish to give up. But my goodness, I've met so many people who've enjoyed it and still enjoy it to this day. And those people deserve a voice. And if it's down to me to help and Forrest to give those people a voice, then we will continue to do it for as long as we can. And like you, I believe that there's more than one point of view in any argument, whether it's smoking, vaping, use of alcohol, any lifestyle issue. And between us, you, me, and all the other people who are out there fighting this fight, I think we deserve to be heard, and we've got to keep going.
Fantastic. Well, there we go, folks. Smoke them if you got them. They're going to be banned soon. Thank you for joining us for another episode of Swift Half. We'll be back in a couple of weeks. Do stay in touch with the IEA. Look at our website, iea.org.uk, particularly the bit that ends /donate. Like us and whatever. Follow us on YouTube and Instagram or whatever else we're on. Take care. See you next time. Goodbye.